a Jewish perspective on homosexuality, talking to children about God. Defections from the Church of England begin, China bars Christians from a conference, from boys to men in advertising, and a milestone in motherhood passes. This is Monday, October 18, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Rabbi Shmuley Boteach and I have tangled more than once on national television. He's the author of a new book entitled Renewal, A Guide to the Values-Filled Life. In Friday's edition of the Wall Street Journal, he writes about his Jewish perspective on homosexuality. He writes, "Some people of faith insist that homosexuality is gravely sinful because the Bible calls it an abomination. But that word appears approximately 122 times in the Bible." Rabbi Boteach goes on to relativize the Bible's teaching on homosexuality, and of course for him this means the Old Testament. He speaks of the fact that homosexuality is, he says, a sin. He says this, "Homosexuality is a religious, not a moral sin. A moral sin involves injury to an innocent party." Now, in his interesting article, Rabbi Boteach makes a very fascinating liberal Jewish argument. He suggests that the two tables of the law of the Old Testament are divided between religious sins and moral sins. He suggests that homosexuality is a religious sin, not a moral sin. Now, this is a very interesting example of Jewish reasoning. Of course, Christians looking at the Ten Commandments and following in the context of the Old Testament itself will understand that there is no distinction between religious and moral sin. All sins are grievous offense against God, a violation of His law, an act which by commission or omission separates us from God, disobeys God, and defies His rule. Now, as we look at this particular line of reasoning, we recognize that this allows Rabbi Boteach to hold a very comfortable liberal ground. He can hold that homosexuality is a sin, but he can define it as a religious sin, and then he relativizes religious sins as not being of very great significance. Moral sins are his basic concern, and he directs his attention at moral sin toward things other than homosexuality. When it comes to homosexual couples, he tells them that they should, and I'm quoting him here, go create a kosher home, turn off the TV on the Sabbath, and share your meals with many guests. Pray to God three times a day, for you are His beloved children. He desires you and seeks you out. Rabbi Boteach says that he supports legalized same-sex unions, but not marriage, because he doesn't believe in redefining marriage. But clearly, he calls for the legalization of same-sex relationships. He says this, "All I ask of my religious brethren is this, even as you oppose gay relationships because of your beliefs, please be tortured by your opposition." He cites the Bible saying, "It is not good for man to be alone." Now, this is a very strange argument, you would think, for a rabbi to make. It's a very liberal argument that allows him to hold out the hope of normalized, legalized same-sex relationships, to affirm them, and yet to say that because of tradition, he doesn't want to redefine marriage. And when it comes to this idea of two different kinds of sin, religious sin and moral sin, well, we can see that could be a very convenient dichotomy. But the reality is, the Scripture doesn't allow any such dichotomy, any such division. All sin is, well, religious sin. Otherwise, we wouldn't use the word sin, and every single sin has a moral dimension to it as well. What we're witnessing in this particular article is not all that surprising. It's yet another effort to try to get out from under the authority of the Bible. Christians must recognize that this is a problem when we look to the Old Testament, because exactly what Rabbi Boteach is doing here is what many other scholars have attempted to do. But of course, our position on homosexuality, as revealed in the Scripture, is not primarily rooted in the Old Testament law, but rather in the New Testament. A passage like Romans 1 is far more determinative of our understanding, offering a far more comprehensive placement of homosexuality within a moral and theological framework. Bruce Feiler is an interesting character. He's the author of several books, including America's Prophet, How the Story of Moses Shapes America. In Sunday's edition of the New York Times, he wrote a fascinating column entitled, For a Child, God's Backstory. The scenario is this. He writes of one of his 5-year-old twin daughters, Eden, jumping into his lap and asking him a question. "Daddy, if I speak to God, will He listen?" Fowler admits that he was quite surprised, indeed shocked. He writes, "In my panic, I had 3 quick thoughts. First, who told you about God? I certainly hadn't initiated the conversation, and I thought I knew everything she learned in school. Second, I should be able to nail this question. I had spent a dozen years tracing biblical stories around the world and had written 4 books about God. Surely I had learned something. Third, and more important, I didn't want to say anything that I would have to unsay later. In other words, I didn't want to lie to her just because she was a child. End quote. Now, this is a fascinating article for many reasons, but one of those reasons is that here we find a father who is having a difficult time knowing exactly how much unbelief to share with his child. He writes that others have been in a similar predicament. On the other hand, those he describes as fundamentalists, he suggests have it easy. He writes, "When it comes to talking to children, fundamentalists have it easy, I have observed. They can simply express their convictions. But what about the rest of us? Are we supposed to share our uncertainties with our children or pretend we know all the answers and let them discover their own ambiguities in due time?" Fowler writes of interviewing some people in order to gather wisdom. He first talked to John Patrick Shanley, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his play, Doubt. He suggested that when his child asked the question, "Where is God?" he simply says, "God is everywhere." He suggests that children should learn by paradox and contradiction. He writes of his 2 now 18-year-old adopted sons, quote, "Children watch your actions and see whether or not you're a doddering fool, and they see if you're a reasonably effective person and you can embrace ambiguity as a positive thing. They say, 'I want to be like that.'" He wrote of his own ambiguity, for instance. He said that his sons saw that he said grace when they were in the country, but not when they were in the city. They knew that he knelt to pray for them each night, but they never went to church. So Mr. Shanley suggests that ambiguity and contradiction are what should be shared with children. Rabbi David Wolpe, author of the book Teaching Your Children About God, suggests that children should be told honestly about what their parents believe about God. But he went on to say, if you want to share with your kids your deepest beliefs are not about shopping. They're about what happens after you die or what life is about. I can't tell you how many times I do funerals and ask the children, did you ask your parents what they thought would happen after they die? The answer in 80% of the cases is no, which I find shocking. The last person that Fowler spoke to was Bart Ehrman, a New Testament scholar at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a well-known agnostic. He said this, "The fact that parents are unsure of their own beliefs is no excuse for not talking to your kids. It's like saying you're not sure what to do about the problem of joblessness or hunger or homelessness. Just because you don't have the solution doesn't mean you don't want to talk about it. The problem with our society is that everybody is interested only in the answers." He goes on and says, there's precedent for telling a child something that you don't really think is true. But in my view about religious things, parents ought to be brutally honest. When I was transitioning, I was completely truthful with my kids and I told them, I don't know, quite often. Now, what Mr. Ehrman is talking about there is transitioning from belief to unbelief, to agnosticism. So how would they each answer the question asked by the 5-year-old? Mr. Shanley said he would tell the 5-year-old, yeah, God does listen when you talk to him. The rabbi said, yes, God listens, but not like people listen, and he doesn't respond like people do either. As for Bart Ehrman, he said this, you know what, little Jimmy? I don't believe in God. What do you think? Well, I think it must be extremely difficult, I must say, for an unbelieving parent to answer honestly a child's questions about God. The answers given in this particular article are excruciatingly awkward, empty, and indeed depressing. This should be a wake-up call for all of us when we remember the great privilege we have to speak to our children about our belief and confidence in God. When the Synod of the Church of England voted in recent months to approve the election of women as bishops, and when it did so without any concessions whatsoever to conservatives who were opposed to the ordination of women as priests, much less as bishops, many suggested that defections would soon begin. Of course, all of this was exacerbated by the fact that Pope Benedict XVI offered a means whereby Anglican priests could indeed convert to Roman Catholicism. Now it's happened, not only with a priest, but with a bishop. The Right Reverend John Broadhurst, the Bishop of Fulham, has indeed announced he's leaving the Church of England and taking on Catholic orders. He suggested that there would be a veritable avalanche of others who would follow in his example. Now, as you look at this news story, you recognize some very familiar and parallel patterns here. In recent years, some of the churches leaving the Liberal Episcopal Church USA have had the grief of losing their facilities or being involved in very long and protracted court fights over the ownership of those church buildings. Some of the congregations leaving the ELCA over similar issues, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, have found that leaving cherished institutions and relationships was very excruciating. Now, in the case of this particular bishop exiting to the Roman Catholic Church, as an evangelical, we would have to say that he's leaving one set of problems for a very old and historic, different set of problems. But, nonetheless, it shows that there are many who are dissatisfied with the liberal direction of the Church of England. Going to Rome is no option. But staying in a denomination that is involved in such theological liberalism and concession is also not an option for anyone who's committed to the Scriptures. Reaching that decisive point where one must leave, well, that's a very difficult judgment call for many. Love and affection for denominational institutions and traditions, churches, and even buildings runs very deep. But we must remember that affection for the truth, for the gospel, for the Word of God, must run much deeper. We are reminded once again that China remains a despotic dictatorship when news out of Beijing indicates that the Chinese government has prevented a group of Chinese Christians from attending a meeting, a crucial evangelical gathering in South Africa. This is the third Lausanne Congress on World Evangelization. And Chinese Christians have been invited with the cooperation of the official church in China, the state-recognized church, and yet, at the last minute, the Chinese government barred their trip to South Africa for this conference. In another tragic and typical example of communist doublespeak, the government said that it was barring its own citizens from attending this meeting about their own cherished faith, quote, for your own good. Well, if indeed we needed any confirmation about the despotic nature of the Chinese regime, there it is. Let's remember that what's going on in China is a market liberalization. They're trying to embrace a free market of sorts, but they do not accept individual liberties and the notion of individual freedom based upon human dignity for each of its citizens. When a government bars its citizens from worship, from attending conferences and events that have to do with their own faith, and says it's doing so for their own good, in the background is the smile of Karl Marx, who defined religion as the opiate of the masses. From time to time, the most interesting section of the New York Times is the Sunday style page. The photographs often convey a great deal. That's certainly the case in Sunday's edition, when on the front of the style section is an article with two shirtless men entitled, From Boys to Men. Now, let me tell you what's going on here. This is a very interesting story about fashion and about advertising, suggesting that all of a sudden there has been a reversion from the boy characters that are used in so many advertisements for men to a far more adult and masculine form. A great interest in this crucial turning point in our economy and in our culture toward men who look like they have a little experience, a little brawn, and might actually have a job. This story is even more interesting once it's read. Reporter Guy Tabray reports that, in recent years, advertisers have used a masculine form he describes as a skinny skate rat. But that's going out. Now, the men who are showing up in advertisements look like they might actually have a job. As one observer said, in times like these, you fall back on old notions of what it meant to be a man or to look like one. Now, here's how it's described. You lose the t-shirt and the skateboard. You buy an interview suit and a package of Gillette Mach 3 blades. You grow up, in other words. Speaking of this change, one advertiser said, the twink thing seems over. When people open GQ, I don't want them to feel like they're looking at clothes on a 16-year-old. Now, the sociological explanations suggested in this article are probably at least partly relevant. One man said, quote, at a time of underemployment and digitized labor that doesn't have real products at the end of the process, people want to be reminded through the images of pop culture that we as men do work, that we labor, that we still make things, end quote. Now, there's been a great deal of attention to the boy crisis in America, and part of that crisis has been that the cultural symbols of manhood have largely disappeared, replaced by just older and perhaps bigger boys. This is a healthy turn. Now, this doesn't mean a return to a biblical notion of manhood and womanhood, but at least it means some kind of reversion to sanity. It tells us something when the New York Times style section suggests that the twink day is over and the skinny skate rat is no longer the model of modern manhood. In a strange and perhaps oddly comforting way, we should take that as good news. Actress Barbara Billingsley died on Saturday at age 94. She was famous, of course, for playing June Cleaver on television's venerable Leave It to Beaver. She was the picture of modern motherhood for many American families watching television back in the black and white era, and she, along with several other television moms, became symbols that were admired at the time but quickly derided later as examples of a submissive, servile, stay-at-home mom who should have been, her later sisters said, in the workplace. One of the interesting things about the obituary in the New York Times about Barbara Billingsley is how much she ended up admiring June Cleaver. Even though she acted in very few roles after that TV iconic role, she had great affection for June. And, like June Cleaver, Barbara Billingsley had two boys. But, unlike June Cleaver, Barbara Billingsley was not able to stay home with her two boys. She wrote about June, she was a loving, happy, stay-at-home mom, which I think is great. She spoke of moms who were able to stay home with their children, saying that this is the most important job they'll ever have. Now, when you look at this particular obituary, you see something of the passage of an American icon. And not just, of course, Barbara Billingsley, but the character for whom she had so much affection, June Cleaver. One of the things we note in sarcastic and cynical modern America is that as much as the feminists have derided June Cleaver, Americans still love to watch Leave It to Beaver, and there is an obvious longing that goes beyond nostalgia for those days when children came home to a mother in the home. By the way, there's some interesting little anecdotes in this obituary. June Cleaver, of course, was famous for wearing pearls, and she was derided by many for always looking so prim and proper. But it turned out that Barbara Billingsley wore the pearls because of an imperfection on her neck. It was just that simple. That is how television iconography gets started. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to albertmohler.com, where you will find regularly posted articles and other resources. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. I want to remind you about the W Conference, which is all about connecting women and the Word. Its main speaker will be our very own Mary Cassian, one of the best-known authors in the field of women's ministry. Leading the music will be Heather Payne, who for many years was the lead singer with the group Point of Grace. The W Conference will be held November 19 through 20 on the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. For more information and to register, go to www.sbts.edu. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.